Today, the opinions we are presented today are going to be of very diverse origin. We have people who are versed in very diverse academic disciplines. And hopefully the discussion is going to be well-rounded and is going to kind of get at all facets of America's political condition and the political future, and especially the left and what it means today and what it needs to do in the future to remain a viable option for the population in this democracy. So without further ado, if you would all please join me in welcoming our panel. And I think today what we should probably do is begin with Dr. Mathewson, because he is going to offer us perhaps a broad interpretation of liberalism, conservatism, and the like. Try to give us a basis on which to have the remainder of our discussion.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to tell a couple stories, because after all of politics is storytelling. And I think this will illustrate my points about liberalism and what's wrong and what it should be doing. And the first is, I have my honors class this semester reading William Faulkner's Intruder in the Dust. And they're supposed to be here, but I don't see any of them here. So anyway, there's this great scene in Faulkner's Intruder in the Dust where this young man, Chick Mallison, he's 13 or 14 years old, goes into the house of Lucas Beauchamp. This is in Mississippi in the 1930s. And he goes into the house of Lucas Beauchamp, who is a black man in the county, and he says, and Faulkner is narrating through the young man, he says, "I smell the smell of Negro. The Negroes smell different." And he goes on, as Faulkner does in this narrative, and then Chick, the young man, says, "Then I figured out it was not the smell of Negro, it was the smell of poverty." And that is what I think the left needs to get back to focusing on, is the politics of class and the politics of the poor. And because we've spent so much time arguing about identity politics over the last few years that we forgot all about, on the left, what our base core constituency is, which not only is the poor, but labor. And labor has abandoned the left. And I'll tell you why, because I'm going to use another little story. And this is another little personal thing about myself. Now, I grew up in this little poor town, and I smelled the smell of poverty, because I grew up in poverty. And there was no way I would have ever had a chance to go to university, except at that time in the 60s, the Cal State system was affordable for everyone. Now they've raised your tuition, and people like me and my peers now, who are your parents, are saying things like, "Well, I made it on my own. Why can't you make it on your own?" Well, that's all bullshit, because they didn't make it on their own, and I can testify to that. It cost me $2,000 a year to go to a state university. That's room, board, tuition, books, and everything. In 60s dollars, you can do that for inflation, and it comes out nowhere near to what your cost of going to college is now. But anyways, getting back to my story. So I'm up there in Bishop, and the only way that I can get down to even go to a state university is Southern California Edison had a program for the two seniors every year at Bishop Union High School, where it was a scholarship deal, but you had to work all summer. And you had to work up there in the mountains on a crew, and so I saved all my money, and I would use that to pay for my school. And I graduated with no student loans, and I never worked during school, because I saved the money in the summer, and that was the deal. But getting back to the story, so I'm up there every summer on this crew. And these guys that I'm on this crew with, and they are some kind of characters, guys like, they're named Buzz Coons and Win Weaver and Big Otto and Mundo Horte, and these are all labor union guys. And this is in the 60s, and this is where my political education came from, and they were all Democrats. And their motto in life, you know, and the motto I still remember, they say, "A day's work for a day's pay." And that's the way Big Otto and all of those guys operated. And they wanted a fair wage from the company, and they're willing to put in a fair wage or a fair day's work to get it. Now, you know what happened to all these guys? They became Reagan Democrats. And I was just a bishop last summer at this wedding, and old Buzz, and they were all there, and we were all sitting around drinking and everything. And they are still Republicans, and they still voted for Bush in both elections. Now, these are guys That was the core of the Democratic Party in the 60s. And it's like the Democrats abandoned the way they feel it is. The Democrats abandoned them, the core constituency. And because the Democrats just gave up on labor. And they gave up on the question of poverty, and they gave up on the question of class. And to me, it's all about class. I mean, when you look at the fact that 1% of the people in this country own 38% of the wealth, I mean, it's about class. And that's what we got to get back to talking about. Now, these guys in the labor movement, they believe in one thing, and this is what liberals have to get back to in their message, and that is a man works all day or a woman works all day, and that person ought to make enough money to provide shelter for himself and his family, food, and adequate medical care. That's all. Now, that's a fair bargain, but that's not happening, and that's what they're complaining about. Now, let's look at those that cannot work, those that are disabled, the elderly. The Democrats have to stand up and say, okay, for these people, they are also going to be provided shelter, food, medical care without stigma attached. Now, we've got enough money in this country to do that. And for the left to come back and be a viable force in American politics, it has got to go back, and it has got to get guys like Mundo, Wynn Weaver, Big Otto back in the party and on our side. And until they do, I am sure the left is condemned to marginality in American politics.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mathewson. I think now we'll go towards Drs. Lavelle and DeMone. We've heard Dr. Mathewson argue very lucidly that labor has abandoned the left and that Democrats have abandoned labor. And you know, some of these terms might be ambiguous to some people in the audience. So perhaps, Professor, if we'll begin with you, Dr. Lavelle, what is the difference between, and is there a difference between liberals, leftists, Democrats? Can you clarify these terms?
Well, I think that there's definitely a difference between certainly liberals and leftists, or between the Democratic Party and the left. I agree with Dr. Mathewson that the left should be focused on class, but then I believe that he conflates the left with the Democratic Party by ending his discussion suggesting that the Democratic Party has to, which is synonymous with the left, has to reclaim its focus on class. Well, I don't really think that the Democratic Party primarily has had class as its main cause. The left is focused on class. And particularly, the leftist critique of politics as usual is really a leftist critique, is really a critique on capitalism. And so I think one of the key differences between liberals and leftists, or between the Democratic Party and leftists, is the focus on the global capitalist structure. Now, leftist is not concerned with whether Bush or Kerry is in charge of this global capitalist structure, so long as there continues to exist a global capitalist structure. And I think that one could try to make a class-based structure more humane, and I would certainly agree that the Democratic Party attempts to do that. But the key difference for me between the left and liberals is is the centrality it places on capitalism as perpetuating the smell of poverty, if you will.
Well, Dr. DeMone, Dr. Lavelle essentially says that the Democrats in America are not in many ways, shape, or forms real leftists. That they're, am I right, that they're sort of leftist light to some extent. Perhaps you could offer some perspective as opposed to maybe other countries. Dr. DeMone, if no one knows, is a professor of French on this campus. What do Democrats look like in America, and what does leftist politics look like in Europe?
Well, most Europeans would agree that there is no left in American politics, that the left has been completely marginalized. There is no left in the Democratic Party, really. If you compare with the French spectrum of political parties, we have, and the French, maybe Nancy can explain the origin of the term left from the French Revolution, but in France, the left is dominated by two parties, the Socialist Party which has about 30% of the votes traditionally, except in the last elections, and the Communist Party, which has had between 10-12% of the votes, and then many other small parties, whereas the right has two main parties, the UDF and RPR, and plus the growing Front National, which is a nationalistic, anti-immigrant, xenophobic, and anti-Semitic, and so on, pretty much a neo-fascist party of Jean-Marie Le Pen. Some French commentators have argued that the Democrats would be the equivalent of the right-wing parties, and the Republicans would be the equivalent of the extreme right. Now, how do you get to have a spectrum of parties represented in this bipartisan system that you have here? That's the difficulty. There needs to be some change at that level so that other parties can be represented. As an example, in France and most European countries, when we have elections, both legislative and presidential, there are two rounds, 1 week apart. One Sunday, you go and vote, actually vote. You put the name of the candidate that you prefer from an array of maybe 20 different parties. And a week later, the next Sunday, you go back and vote for the one of the two who got most votes in the first round. And so even though it does end up being a binary, you need a binary party to make sure that you have 50% plus one votes. But at least you see this 1 week of forming coalitions, and you really feel that the smaller parties on the left, as well as on the right, have a voice.
Okay. Dr. Redhead, up till now we've been kind of talking about left, right, what is the left, what is the right. How about if you kind of introduce a new term to what we're talking about today? How about progressivism and what that means and how that fits into this dichotomy, or if it does at all?
Well, thanks, Robert, for a nice segue. I personally just find the terms right-left to be just incredibly reductionist and a bad binary. Because for me, it seems that so much of effective coalition building is between people who don't, necessarily fit into the right or left split to begin with. How many people have every single political opinion that they have on one side of that equation as opposed to the other side, or exclusively on one side or the other side? Politics itself is an incredibly multidimensional activity. People generate different allegiances to different causes at different times, i.e. there are many Catholic people out there for social justice who are on the other side of the fence when it comes to abortion. What do you do with them? So I prefer to think of my brand of politics is progressive in nature. One thing I will say, though, because this seems to be a very Americanist discussion, that I do admire about the so-called American right is the pride of place that they kind of give to philosophers and to the intellectuals. In the case of the neocons, look at their great disciple Leo Strauss and the pride of place that he has in their movement, and the fact that, love them or hate them, these guys tend to be able to build bridges between their activists and the current thoughts within their intellectual quarters. It's always kind of depressing to me for the American progressive side of the equation, we seem to have links between the Noam Chomskys and Ward Churchill, so I think do a very good job of getting, people at the freshman, sophomore level kind of involved. But we don't seem to have to generate the same links between more sober and, I think, more sophisticated minds, such as Wendy Brown or Sheldon Wolin or Shayla Ben-Habib, whose work is in many ways confined against their wishes. These are very activist-oriented people who go out there and speak in public forums, but their work is primarily confined to the ivory tower. Now, I just kind of get on my little soapbox here for a second, because that seems to be what the panel's about, right? Like the other three thinkers, I would argue today that, that the big problem for many progressives, and one which, you know, my own little way I try to develop, put an earnest amount of intellectual effort towards, is thinking through, you know, an alternative framework to the blend of Thatcherism and Hobbesianism with an evangelical aftertaste that seems to be so dominant at the moment. The right, if you want to call it the right, is itself involved in class politics. It's also involved in a weird form of identity politics, and it's involved in another politics which I think is incredibly pernicious, and this is the anti-society naturalization form of politics. So just naturalize the status quo of capitalism to create these students who come to class and say, well, it's all subjective, Professor Redhead. I can't change anything, so I might as well go get a job in Leviathan and, you know, go march comfortably onto Tustin with credit card bills and an SUV I can't afford in the driveway. rock on, dude. I want to say, though, that somehow progressives have to think through, you know, an alternative framework. Because so much of progressive thought and action today is, in many ways, has a form of almost a reactionary critique rather than being undertaken through a critical and emancipatory theory of society. It's like, the war sucks, this sucks, and, well, what doesn't suck? Well, here's some warm and fuzzy thing, but I can't really, you know, that somehow goes back to 19th century theorists like Marx and that, but we're not going to really spell it out. So, for example, before teaching here, I lived in Oregon, and you had people heavily into Jesus, and then you had, you know, aging hippies who literally read Marx like Marx was the disciple. There's no critique of Marx. I'm thinking, how thoughtful is that? So this raises the question, well, okay, Mark, well, what is progressivism about? Well, progressives, you know, have to answer the question, basically, progress to what? And given that history, you know, sorry to say, is not an inherently progressive act. This is my, you know, big beef with liberal thinkers. Liberals tend to have this kind of, you know, warm and fuzzy Kantian version of history that, you know, we're all going to progress through the great kind of cosmopolitan republic and everybody's going to be happy and reason's going to prevail. And no, I don't think the historical record bears that out. Nor is it really cyclical, nor is it thesis, antithesis, or synthesis. Progressive thought, given that, has to, I would argue, be on an epistemological level, something oriented towards a criteria for evaluating change. Change here as the direction in which a given set of practices have moved in one direction or another. What might this mean? Well, for me, I argue that I have a twofold kind of argument that I would raise here. On a personal level, you know, I like to judge present politics by its progress towards, among other things, and I'll just list off of some ranting points here, that, you know, given the actual capacities of the world at the moment, the gross national products of the entire globe, it seems to me that there should be no harmless people or no homeless people. There should be no starvation. If we're living in a progressive globe, then we should have no people dying of diseases in which some adequate treatment can be provided for out there, but some forces of capitalism say, you know, do not provide the means for that. It might also be nice if we had a world in which all human beings, not just quote Americans, because as I'll point in a minute, I don't see why the moral worth of somebody in Bakersfield should count more than the moral worth of somebody in China or in Mexico, given relations of interdependence spawned by globalization. Why shouldn't all human beings have a universal basic income? I don't see why that's unreasonable. Nor do I see why I should have to pay taxes to support research into the weaponization of food or the militarization of nanotechnology. But these are just, you know, my preferences, which are my own little personal rants about progressivism. It's, you know, kind of the politics that I want to see the world move towards. But when I put on my political theory cap, I think of progressivism as oriented towards a critique of present political practices from the perspective of democracy, and in particular, democratic control of capitalism and the state. Now, what does that mean? Well, democratic control of capitalism means two things: collective decisions about, one, what features of our collective lives should be subject to capitalist forces? Should illnesses be subject to capitalist forces? Well, no, I don't think so. You know, healthcare should be something that's off the capitalist map. Education should be something to its large degree should be off the capitalist map. A progressive society has detailed democratic debates about this stuff. You know, what are the limits of capitalism? What are the areas of life it should go into, and what shouldn't it go into? And the second form of democratic control of capitalism is what forms of capitalist practices should be permitted, and more importantly, what inequalities are to be permitted and what not. You know, I'm sick and tired of turning on the TV and having knee-jerk glorifications of social Darwinism. On the one hand, or warm and fuzzy crap, you know, which a lot of, quote, lefties in Santa Monica driving their Hummers with their Kerry bumper stickers, you know, get off on. It's like, it's okay to be rich. Well, why is it okay to be rich? What justifies your Hummer in your million-dollar house? Give me a detailed moral justification of that. A good democratic society has that dynamic about it. Democratic control of the state means what? Means, I would argue, applying the principle of affected interest to all manifestations of state power. Not just national state power, but interstate power, intrastate power, local state power. The principle of affected interest is simply this, that those most affected by a given state action should have the greatest say in sanctioning it. To be progressive in some way, shape, or form is to see that democracy is about the principle of affected interest. It's not about just going out and voting. It's about those who are facing the brunt of some state action having a deep say in how that state action is to be sanctioned and how it is to occur. It's also, when it comes to state, a process of doing what? Of making the actions of the state more transparent. One of the biggest issues we face at the moment is the issue of complexity, speed, and time, and how so much of what states do slides under the radar, is not opened up for critique, and is therefore rendered legitimate, even though it might very, very well be illegitimate. The final pillar on democratic action here is to see that democratic action is also a-statist. It's not anti-state, it's not pro-state, it's a-statist. States themselves as purveyors of sovereign power and what Foucault rightly calls governmentality, because states not only exert power against individuals, they also create individuals. What are we doing here in schools? We're creating individuals to a certain degree. These are not bastions of democracy. Democratic deliberation has to be focused on sovereignty and governmentality is focused on the exercise and direction of these acts of state power. Democratic deliberate action is then something that is somehow, you know, informs the state but is not part of the state. When the state gobbles up parts of the public sphere, what happens to those parts of the public sphere? They become less democratic. So what does that mean? Well, to practice progressive politics, and I'll just finish my rant here, really I think has three interrelated practices. The first is rethinking the moral commitments that define our collective lives and the political obligations that I would argue that ensue. A good example of this for me is, just think about, again, how globalization, the increasing interdependence of our lives with others, in many ways just illuminates the absurd forms of ideology that run throughout nationalism, and in particular in this country, American nationalism. Think about how American nationalism provides a kind of blinker, or blinds people to larger moral dilemmas, the moral dilemmas that arise from realizing that our lives are interconnected with many people beyond what is, quote, the nation, in people's lives, and the mindless patriotism that ensues from that. The second kind of dynamic of progressive politics, I would argue, this is the one where I think progressives on a daily basis, do much good, is the unmasking of illegitimate because not democratically redeemed or redeemable power relations. The raising hell, continuously raising hell against forms of power that have not passed democratic muster. And the third, which is what I argue is something that one has to strive to do in the classroom, is the imagining of alternative political realities, as well as seeing the contingent, hence eminently changeable nature of present realities. So many students just take the status quo as is, as if this world that we live in isn't contingent. It isn't being constantly reaffirmed and de facto reaffirmed because people don't get up and say something about it as it is. They take your class and say, well, that was nice, Professor Redhead, but now, I'm just going to go gleefully join Leviathan and la-di-da-da-da. The act of teaching and the struggle we face as teachers is in many ways to get people to question why the world is the way it is and how it can be otherwise. In the face of, again, I would say formal, there's lots of formal press that just manufacture individuals and spit them out there into the workforce so they can be, quote, competitive in the global economy, but not necessarily free-thinking individuals concerned with the fate of the global economy, on the one hand, and the implicit pressures from many students themselves. I just want to get a job, dude. On the other hand, you know, these pressures seduce to what? To produce simply docile bodies, very good at processing and implementing orders from above, but not necessarily questioning. So that's my little soapbox rant on progressivism. You know,
thank you very much, Dr. Redhead. Dr. Redhead kind of raised the philosophical bar on many of these issues, but what it kind of boils down to some extent is this idea of sort of an amoral economic capitalistic machine exerting pressure over our lives as opposed to democratic sensibilities. And Dr. Dittman, if we can move to you, I know that you certainly find yourself, if we can go back to some extent the left, you find yourself to the left of a lot of what's going to be talked about today. And maybe you could comment a little bit on what Dr. Redhead was saying as far as the cap. I'm sure you see some of this amoral capitalistic power being exerted through perhaps military force. But just talk a little bit about the left, about the current situation of things for you.
Well, this thing we call this kind of vague left-right dichotomy, political dichotomy. If we're going to suggest any dichotomy, I think those are the most valid terms. They're not mutually exclusive. And there are lots of different issues, and people divide on different issues. Now, I've always been considered to be not only left, but far left, and I don't know of anybody who has disagreed with that assessment.
I thought so you were conservative.
Yeah. Well, that's because I am very conservative, law and order type. But I'm also, but I have to explain those. I mean, they're not just labels. You know, liberal, conservative, I hate that term, because I'm liberal. Everyone should be liberal. It means tolerant, open-minded. Everyone, I think, should be, you know, to start off with being conservative. I'm fiscally very conservative. If you're going to borrow money, I believe in investing it and wisely, not spending it and getting into debt, running up intolerable debts that you can never cope with. I don't believe in embarking upon risky military adventures. I believe in preserving our environment. I believe in our habitat. I don't believe in overpopulating it beyond the carrying capacity of the planet. I don't believe in taking the risk of depending upon pulling out another technological rabbit out of the hat, but we're going to go out on a limb and hope that nature doesn't saw it off. Remember, I saw a bumper sticker once that says, "Nature bats last." Well, I don't want to get in that kind of a position where I have to depend upon another miracle to save us from where we're headed. If we're headed off a cliff, let's change direction instead of hoping that somehow or another someone's going to come down and rescue us. So I'm very conservative in a whole variety of different ways, including what are considered, what I was taught to, were traditional American values, which I support. Of course, the America today is not the America I grew up in. And what the biggest thing that I am disappointed about, because I want a country I can be proud of, and I can't be proud of being the biggest bully in the block. I know we had our imperial moments going back to the Monroe Doctrine. It was never the way I was really taught the way it was in school, but that's still the way I want it to be. Those ideal values, that's what I think we should be striving for. And because we have this great opportunity to lead the world to a higher level of civilization instead of tearing it down back into barbarism, that's my biggest disappointment, is that we are not leading the world. I also am very conservative because I think you achieve security most effectively by cultivating friendships and not making a whole bunch of enemies. So I may be far right, far left, but I'm not extreme left. Now, on some of the other issues that came up, I think, like Matheson was saying, we do have to focus on class. People always want to join the ruling class. Democracy, to me, and I started SDS on campus, you know, they talked about participatory democracy, not casting a vote for some politicians who are going to buy an election so we get the best politicians money can buy. Democracy, I go back to the root meaning of the word. I'm conservative, too. I like the root meanings of words. Don't keep changing them for put spin on them for political purposes. Democracy means power to the people, which is a big slogan during the 60s. Demos, people, and crassy power. power to the people. Now, there are lots of different ways that that can be accomplished. But, I mean, that's essential. I think democracy would be a far better system than capitalism. I support one person, one vote, not $1, one vote. And I think people should be allowed, as a fundamental principle of democracy, and I wrote this in support of Loretta Sanchez when she was challenged about they had these illegal aliens that were supposedly with Nativo Lopez had cast votes. Well, I think a fundamental principle of democracy is that people ought to be able to express themselves through the electoral process about conditions that grossly affect their lives. I thought it was a big violation of democracy to have Vietnamese peasants have napalm dropped down. They never got to vote whether they wanted that or not. I don't know how, there are practical problems, but to me that's a violation of democracy. When people have things happen to them and they can't even express themselves through a ballot box as whether they want that to happen to them or not. So I think we have to get back to fundamental concepts of democracy, that's not a simple term. When I was on sabbatical in Yugoslavia, I did spend a lot of my time studying the self-management, somewhat Pravinya system while I was there, and a lot of things wrong with that. I won't go into that, but let me mention some of the other things that were brought up to try to keep this short. Focus on class. And when we organized the union on campus here, and I was statewide secretary, president here a couple times, statewide secretary, for both UC and CSU systems. But, then my former attorney, Howie Berman, who's now a congressman, wrote our collective bargaining legislation and essentially imposed it on us. And we didn't have enough power. We didn't have enough bargaining power. But, with whom are we bargaining? What legitimacy do these corporations that run the trustees and the regents, what right do they have? It's a military chain of command system. When I was in a faculty, they call it academic senate now, it used to be faculty council, and at my report to my constituency, I wrote, report from the sandbox. It reminded me of when I was elected to student government in the seventh grade, where we argued about which way you should go up and down the stairs. But when it came to things that were really important, like the budgets and staffing and stuff like that, and they would report. And so I'd ask, well, how do you agree, like to a tenth of a personnel position? How do you agree with the administration's recommendations? Oh, we just happen to agree. You just happen to agree to a tenth of a personnel position? It's like we're just rubber stamps. Well, of course, there are a lot of things. They don't want to get involved with a lot of the detailed work. So they want you to do the work, but they keep the power. That's essentially the way the system works. So you get this patina of democracy, but it's not real democracy because the things that are really important, like budget, access to working class students, to higher education, staffing, space allocations, all of that, which used to be our business under the meet and confer model, now is no longer any of our business. And union has become, and I wrote an article to criticize it, they asked me to, they would never publish it. 10 years later, said, update it. They would never publish it still. But it hadn't. The Western Service Workers Association did republish it, because I think unions not have to be class conscious. They have to be socially responsible. It's not enough to just have organized selfishness, to restrict yourself to bread and butter issues. We have to create a better society. We have to create a better country. We have to create a better world. And I think that if you don't have progressive unions, you're not going to have a progressive movement. We have to. That's where people can have the most effect. In other areas, we are at a severe disadvantage because of the concentration of wealth. So when it comes to the media, mostly owned outright and controlled outright by capitalists, and some people say it's a liberal media. My God, how do you manage to get to the right of the capitalists who own the media? But you can be. Attila the Hun, I suppose, is to the right of the U.S. capitalist class, the ruling class here, which is why we started KPFK, helped start KPFK back in Pacifica Foundation back in 1958, because we recognize the problem that is even more, much more severe now. PR and lobbying, again, you're at a big disadvantage. When people meet with each other, especially in a workplace, when you have the power of withholding your labor, that's when you start getting some political clout. So I encourage progressive labor unions. I join them. I'm emeritus now, I still teach, but I join the Graduate Students Union. Just, I joined the Secretary's Union when I was president of the on campus. I joined other unions just for support.
Thank you, Dr. Dittman. Dr. Dittman brought up an interesting concept of sort of conservative liberalism, and he's talking about, in many ways, America is not the same place in which he grew up. Maybe for some more historical context, we'll move to Dr. Fitch. You know, America is a much different place, in many ways for better and in many ways for worse. But in a broad historical context, what does the absence of grand social projects like, you know, New Deal, for example, or Great Society, in favor of today we hear terms like privatization, ownership society, Dr. Dittman would probably refer to these as organized selfishness. What does this tell you about the political ideology of America today, Dr. Fitch?
Okay, let me, before I go directly into that, let me address something that Helene, Professor Dumont mentioned, because I think it may be of interest to some of you here, and that is where do the whole idea of right and left come from in terms of European history or European context? And it actually comes from the French Revolution, where people who were most radical, it was sort of a big circle, and people who were most radical sat on the left by their friends who were radical and sat on the left, and people who were conservative, royalist, maybe wanted to bring the monarchy back, sat on the right with their friends. And those are words that have stuck for a long time.
They still do.
In France, yeah, right and left. And they still sit in order of where they see themselves on the right and the left. And actually, if you look at the records of the parliamentary proceedings, they always include in parentheses whenever somebody says something, you know, hisses from the left or booing from the right. Or tomatoes from the right, so that you not only, and this could be people like you, so you not only get the sense of what people are saying, and a lot of it is from people within the parliament, but I actually had the opportunity to sit in some of these meetings a couple years ago, and yeah, I mean, people would boo and hiss, and the recorder would mark that down, whether this opinion was consistent with what the right was saying or the left was saying. So these are old terms, and those are where they came from. The question that was posed to me were these great projects like the New Deal, and I'll just sort of talk about some of where I come from in my own background, which is a little great politics, and that's the movement of the 1960s, where lots of people were engaged in what we thought at the time were progressive activities, wanting to change everything in the world, wanting to working for civil rights, where we saw people being disenfranchised, working against the war, which we thought was a capitalist encounter that the United States was involved with, working to reform school systems, that there was something deeply wrong with education, that it was too much of professors lecturing at students, and the need for students to generate their own agendas in some ways, and to have a much more meaningful dialogue. And I think throughout that movement, and it never really got reflected in politics in the terms of the Senate or the House of Representatives, but it very much was a serious political movement in which I think people did imagine alternative political realities. And it wasn't just in the United States, it was in other parts of the world. France again. I also am familiar with people who were involved in these kinds of imaginations of alternative political realities in Brazil. And I, you know, being involved, I think the United States is probably universally looked on upon as the most reactionary, but people in other parts of the world have also, you know, had to grapple with what's gone wrong, where are we now politically? Where are the imaginations? What's happening? And you know, and several people here have mentioned global capitalism, and I recall talking about this maybe 15, 16 years ago, and there was an issue of a journal called the Radical History Review, and the cover of it, I think, sums some of this up. It was May 1968, Remaking the World. Must have been 1988. May 1988, Remaking the Kitchen. And, I think that does reflect this sense of people becoming more thing-oriented, people becoming more acquisitive, the predominance of global capitalism and letting global capitalism in many ways, I think, shape where people are. I'm glad you asked me the question about things like the New Deal, because it's, from my own perspective, it seems like, yeah, you need these great projects, but now we desperately need a left that's willing to preserve some of those great projects, that the New Deal, Social Security, some of the, as limited as they were, politics of Medicare, a lot of these sorts of things are seriously under attack right now. And I do believe we should imagine alternative political realities, but I also am sensitive to a lot of some of the things that have been said today, the capitalist ownership of media and really the inability to get beyond that and creating a discourse that becomes very difficult to cut into. Privatization are all things that I think the left really needs to figure out how to, you know, we need to imagine alternative political realities, but I also think we need to preserve some of this sense of collectivity that it once seemed to have existed in this country with some of these politics of maybe minimal safety nets, but very much safety nets for people that really don't exist anymore. And then one last thing I want to say, and again, I think this goes back to the notion of imagining alternative political realities, is that in the 18th century, prior to the French Revolution, the political philosophy of the time, in many, many respects, there were conservative movements as well, but spoke very positively of change. And they not only saw change as possible, they saw change as desirable. And I think that's part of what's going on in this country today, is the failure to see change as something that's desirable. And it really doesn't matter which party you're looking at. I think the left needs to regain somehow the sense that change is both possible and desirable.
Thank you very much, Dr. Page. Professor Brody, you were a professional in the journalism field before you were a professor at Cal State Fullerton. You've heard Dr. Dittman kind of poke fun at the fallacy of the liberal media, and Dr. Finch mentioned it as well. Talk to us, if you could, about the so-called liberal media. Is the media more than ever the voice of society's power holders? And how does the internet and internet communication fit into political ideology, political discourse in this country?
You know, I heard a lot of these arguments that were said today by my colleagues in the panel 25 years ago when I was in school. And so sometimes I worry about what's wrong with the left is that, like McLuhan said, we move to the future by looking through the rearview mirror. The world has changed a lot in the last 25 years. And a lot of the ideas, is labor dead? Am I going to be more, is the Democratic Party a bourgeois party? Am I going to be, out liberal you or liberals, bad? We should be more radical. They were all bandied about when we were changing society in the 60s. So what I would suggest is, yes, you can look at corporate control of the media, But something else has arisen, and I was trying to explain it to you last week. Robert, we had this discussion about what I was going to talk about is that, you know, now you have the growth of the net, and if you want the democratization of media, you have it in the internet. You can see examples like with MoveOn.org or the Dean campaign or even what Huffington's trying to do. So I think that rather than harp on that, you know, GE owns NBC and Time Warner and CNN are together and Disney owns ABC, and I could give you a half-hour lecture about that or the great media chains like Gannett, I would say, you know, let's look to the future. Let's look to the not even the future, but the present. Instead of looking in the rearview mirror of what's behind us, look at our present today. You have the ability to reach anyone in the world. You can set up websites. There are enough internet service providers. You can have this connection and connectivity, and you can take on the power structure. You can have pictures of Abu Ghraib, you know, across the world. You have pictures of atrocities across the world. You have a connection of media where you, for the first time in history, you know, you have basically unmediated messages. You don't need big media. For I can go on my Ford and server and, you know, dispense the world, you know, through my own personal website. You can do it on your own website. You can do it on AOL. And there has been some fantastic progress in that direction. What I think what we need to do on the left is, you know, utilize media, be aware, you know, of its potential. Don't harp on, you know, trying to change the world through the New York Times. You can set up your own blog. And this also, yes, it, you don't know. I mean, look at jibjab.com. You know, like, this is ridiculous. You know, look at jibjab.com. It was a parody that reached, you know, like millions of Americans just starting out of like one website, you know, being passed around. And there's lots of examples like that. And he doesn't know. And the reason why he doesn't know is he's looking at the present through the rearview mirror. And until we change that and adapt to what we have here in our living world today and what the conditions are, the left will never move forward.
Thank you, Professor Brody. Dr. Emery, thank you for coming. You know, I've read some of your work, and Dr. Emery has written some very interesting articles about U.S. hegemony. And in one, a 2003 article, you were speaking about blossoming hegemony powered by military force and it eliciting global resistance, and some of this manifesting itself in the form of terrorism. We've talked about domestic concerns as well, but is this sort of global spread of capitalism, military force, is this the greatest threat against which the American left needs to address? And in general, just, you know, speaking about your area of expertise with especially with the global resistance.
Well, I think the question is, how do you deal with empire? Yes. That's what it boils down to, right? And I think that is the primary project facing the left, not just the American left, but the left everywhere in the world. So the future of the world hangs in the balance of what is going to happen as a consequence of the American thrust for unilateral hegemony across the world and attempts by other states and other peoples to respond to that. And, you know, you see signs of resistance taking place. In Iraq, the domestic insurgency in Iraq, I think, has politicized the United States, and it's factionalized the consent that the neocons had after 9/11, where there was one discourse about emancipating the world in the name of democracy and American values. And now there's an alternative discourse. That discourse is, you know, there is an empire out there, an imperial project, and people are resisting it. And you see that in the 2004 election, even amongst the Democratic Party, who, most of whom voted and gave consent to the imperial project immediately after 9/11 and in 2002. So the voice of the left is beginning to affect American domestic politics, and it's affecting global politics too. It's affecting America's relationships with its historic allies in Western Europe, many of whom are now pulling back, saying, well, we're no longer going to be part of the coalition of the willing, which at this point I think, I don't know how many countries are left. Hungary's pulled out, El Salvador's pulled out, the Poles are making noise of pulling out. Right now, Blair looks like he's in trouble, and his main primary trouble is the war in Iraq. So, you know, all of these things are breaking down the legitimacy and, to a certain extent, the hegemony of the American empire, and an alternative discourse is out there. And the left has shaped that discourse decisively. It's raised questions of human rights. It's raised questions of international law. It's raised questions of multilateralism as opposed to unilateralism. And that's all coming from the left, you know. So although we might moan about the left, in the U.S., I think the U.S. left is very weak, but the left is not universally weak across the world. It's uneven in its weakness and its strength. And it takes time to organize these kinds of mass movements, you know. This is not a short-term project. Organizing from below always takes time. It's always easy to organize from above and to take control through a coup or a partial coup like the neocons seem to have done. But to organize from below takes time and involves large numbers of people. So, you know, but that project is beginning to happen, if you ask me.
Thank you, Dr. Emery. Maybe we'll move on to Dr. Dennehy at this point. Dr. Emery said essentially that, actually verbatim, he said the American left is weak. And a lot of the left worldwide is in response to America's imperial project. Now, some would say that Japan, post-1945, is perhaps part of America's imperial project. How does that play itself out in the political sensibilities in Japan and the United States?
Yeah, I'd like to respond to some of Mark's comments that I think are appropriate when looking at the case of Japan, of, you know, that simplistic binary of right and left, you know, doesn't really work, that it's much more fruitful, I think, to look at the multidimensional aspects of right and left, and particularly because of Japan's historical circumstances and the American support for the conservative, quite nationalistic political parties that have really dominated the political scene in Japan since 1945. So if we, you know, complain about, you know, Democrats and Republicans being virtually the same in the United States, in the case of Japan, you have what's called the Liberal Democratic Party, a very conservative, nationalistic bent to this party that's, you know, virtually been dominant since 1945 with the active support of the United States. But there are a couple of really important qualifications to that, that the power of the left coming out of Japan's wartime experience and, you know, the, you know, extreme devastation. Basically, you know, every city in Japan was bombed with the exception of Kyoto during World War II. And so this, you know, urgent sense, especially on the part of the teachers' unions and intellectuals in Japan, you know, where did we fail during wartime? So there's been this constant vigilance on the part of the left in that sector and trying to preserve what was basically a constitution written by Americans in 1946. But this important clause, Article 9 of Japan's constitution, says that we renounce war as a way to resolve international disputes. And, you know, there's a lot of contradictions to that in terms of the way it plays out. They actually do have a very well-financed, you know, high-technology military. But in terms of grassroots support, you know, if you look at the historical evolution of that, you know, through the 50s, you know, very vigilant pacifist grassroots activism, especially against nuclear weapons, obviously, because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was really the trigger for a lot of that. So, you know, in terms of characterizing what it is that's important about the left in Japan, it has more to do with, you know, keeping an eye on the military, keeping an eye on things like, you know, nuclear testing and nuclear weapons. And, you know, one thing in terms of, you know, comparing, say, you know, the Japanese situation to America in terms of global capitalism, that, you know, you see actually, you know, the success. I talked about, you know, the extreme devastation of Japan in 1945, that one thing the conservative parties have been very good at is, you know, building up Japan's economy, and you don't really see that, you know, in comparison with the United States, this, the discussion to me is interesting about class in the United States, because I think most Japanese consistently in the post-war period would label themselves as middle class. And, you know, the comment about, you know, why is it okay to be rich in the United States? I think you see more of a condemnation of that in the case of Japan, that, you know, there is more of a condemnation if you have these big mansions and you're driving your car. You know, I lived with a Japanese family, the president of a big company, and he takes the train on these incredibly crowded subways, you know, with the masses, that, you know, you don't have that same kind of disparity that of income. And, you know, race is also, you know, a very different situation in the case of Japan, so you don't have those same kinds of problems. But certainly in terms, I think, you know, one commonality that I see in the case of Japan, especially among college students and high school students, is a general sense of political apathy and really having been brought in quite thoroughly to this ideology of mass consumerism. You know, the more kinds of, you know, computer games and, you know, Hello Kitty trivia, you know, trinkets and things like that you have, the happier you will be, right? And people really believe that, and that's what makes people happy is to go shopping and to, you know, have, you know, the acquisitive kind of culture that Nancy has mentioned. So
play the lottery.
Yeah, you know, that kind of thing, you know, has a lot of appeal, you know, in general in Japan. And so I think, you know, the left in some sense is facing some of the same problems that the United States is. But in terms of, you know, the war in Iraq right now, you've got Koizumi, the prime minister, you know, very flagrantly out in support of Bush and, you know, becoming really emboldened in a lot of their nationalist agenda in Japan, you know, visiting shrines of the war dead and insisting that, you know, Japanese students stand up and sing their national anthem. I mean, you have a lot of leftist opposition to that among teachers' unions, but in general, I think there's a kind of a sense of political apathy. And, you know, part of that has to do, especially after the burst of the economic bubble in the early 90s, there's a sense of fear among high school and college students, right, that the kinds of economic security that was available to their parents, say, in the 60s and 70s is no longer there. And so not wanting to risk maybe future economic opportunities mm-hmm. with any kind of political activism.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dinahy. There's a lot of comparisons to be made between Japan and America. I think the next question I'll go with you, Professor Jackson. But one of the big differences is Japan is a largely homogeneous culture, or nation state, I should say. Now, in America, the left and the Democratic Party have, at least for the 20th century, the majority of it, been the party to which minorities have been drawn. Today, Republicans, conservatives are getting unprecedented amounts of Hispanic and Asian voters. And by many estimates, John Kerry, for example, in the 2004 election, didn't spend much time courting the black vote. My question is, or really, why is that happening? What does that mean, especially for the left in America?
Well, from my point of view, is the Democratic Party has taken blacks for granted too much so for too long. However, you'll find it not only the Asians and Hispanics are moving more back toward a Republican spectrum, but the African American is doing as well. And because what the Republican Party is doing is inclusion, and where the Democratic Party has been taken for granted and exclusion in a way of speaking, like John Kerry, he didn't spend any time at all in the black community. You're taking it for granted that they're going to vote for me because I'm a Democrat. But with blacks in history, you got to go back to the history of blacks. They're only unique people in America. There's no other group in America that has the history of blacks. And we go back to slavery. Okay? And the foundation, I've been listening to everybody talking about the economics and all this stuff about the Europeans and all that. I have to focus more or less on America and what it means to me. America is based on the blood and sweat of black people in slavery. It would not be what it is had it not had cotton and tobacco to generate that money in order to build its economic base and spread across not only the area of the United States and expansion, but also in the global sense. The Democratic Party, Roosevelt did his thing. We talked about that in the New Deal and all. Thank God for Roosevelt. He did a pretty good job in that and pulled blacks into that when they were disenfranchised by the Republican Party, because most blacks were Republicans before they were Democrats. You understand what I'm saying? That was the part, and Lincoln was no hero of black folks. You understand what I'm saying? People say, oh, Lincoln was, no, he was not. He, you know, he did that to preserve the Union. But it did favor black people because it brought them out of this out of the despair of economic total decay, more toward prominence. But once they had this problem of 1890s and the, you know, the Republican, the era disenfranchisement in terms of separate equal doctrine, you know, be fighting against that. How are you going to have give me separation and equality when you have the first thing? Blacks understood that the separation of the two societies, a black society and a white society. See, you got to be where I'm coming from, where I came from. I'm a Southern, I'm from Florida. You can't go no further than Florida. You understand what I'm saying? I went to a segregated school. I went to a segregated, you know, church, segregated community. And everything about my earlier life was segregated. So I have to look at the reality of what America really means to me. I know what the left. I've been involved with the left, so I know what that's about. In my world, the left was communism, okay? The right was conservatism. But I fall in the middle of all of that. You know, I'm looking for what? Balance, not tilt one way or the other. I'm looking for balance. And I think most black people are doing it. And the Democratic Party don't watch out. To answer your question directly, black people are going to exit us, the Democratic Party. Because you can say what you want about George Bush. I'm no he's no hero of mine. But George Bush has done something that no other Democrat has ever done in the history of the United States. Guess what that is?
Condoleezza Rice?
Not only her, but what else? Hello, what else? You see what I'm saying? So you can talk about all the intellectual stuff that you want. I'm talking about reality.
But some people might consider them as, to some extent, traitors? Or?
Well, not in my world. And I've come from a black world. You understand what I'm saying? And I'm real. And nobody that I know would consider Condoleezza Rice a traitor. They may not like her politics the way she goes on, but she knows we, as a black people coming from slavery, learn how to survive. How do you survive in America being a black man?
Being entrepreneurs?
Huh?
Being an entrepreneur is what you say?
America's based on that. The land of mercantilism. That's the basis of what Dr. Dickman was talking about. And they got rich off the blood and sweat of black folks. Hello. You see what I'm saying? And so my way of thinking, it may be a little bit different, not to put down anything anybody that's sad, but as far as the Democratic Party is concerned, you know, I don't know which way I may vote when it comes up for voting. I'm not going to say I'm going to go and vote for John Kerry runs again, or Hillary Clinton, if she runs. I'd probably vote for Hillary, though. but the point I'm making here is that you can't take black people for granted. The Asians are new in terms of politics. Hispanics are new in terms of politics. Immigration, they are concerned about. Black people don't have no problem with immigration. You understand what I'm saying? So when you talk about that kind of stuff, there are people who have interests in that. We don't. We have interest in what? Economic stability and education. As I go back to what I said earlier, I went to a segregated school, elementary, high school, college, the whole nine yards. And I lived down the street from the University of Tampa. Couldn't go there. I had to go to Fort Valley State, Georgia, a land-grant college in the middle of a cotton field. My way of thinking is different.
But you were a civil rights fighter, so do you think that movement has
civil rights was changed? Great. The left was involved with Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. I was there too. Believe me, I was. He had the left there. The right was not, because that was George Wallace and his group. But the Anglo students who came down from Yale, who came down from Harvard, who came down from all of the northern schools to join in Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee to march, well, from the left. So the left does have a purpose. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not putting the left down. What I'm saying is that we have to put things in proper perspective and not take black people for granted in any sense of imagination about anything. because we too are looking for what? Economic what? Balance. That's what America is about.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson. I'm sure that there's a lot of, everyone on the panel has very much to say. I think we'll go back around. We have 45 minutes. After 20 more minutes, we'll move the questions from the audience. And Dr. Lavelle, you took the least time last time around, so I'm sure that you have much to say.
Yeah, I'd just like to thank my colleagues on the panel here. For once, I'm the least long-winded presenter on any panel, which is strange. I mean, you know, there's so much that I want to respond to. I mean, I was asked a very simple question. Well, I was asked what was seemingly a very simple question, which was, what's the difference between the left and liberalism, you know, progressivism, Democrats, et cetera, et cetera. You know, yeah, we could get bogged down in differences between the left and the right and so on and so forth. What I care about is, right now, when we have got such a right-controlled or conservative-controlled or neocon-controlled administration and branches of government. To me, the left is anything that stands in opposition to those things. Now, for us to sit here and debate the Democratic Party has not been the left as long as I've been alive, and I'll tell you why, okay? These are the things that matter to me as a leftist. Homelessness, poverty, accessible education, that is free education, free health care, not having to worry whether a Secretary of State is black or represents black politics, but represents everybody equally, right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Not having to worry about interpreting Jesus as someone on the right or someone on the left and recognizing the fact that Jesus should not be interpreted in my political structure at all, right? Now, as long as I've been alive, I've known of this concept of poverty. As far as I've been alive, I've recognized something as racism.